It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the state's Department of Corrections has reached a settlement in a lawsuit over conditions at Wisconsin's youth prisons. A reporter gives us the details coming up. First, the U.S. Supreme Court sided with a Colorado baker who refused to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple's celebration. In a 7-2 decision handed down this morning, the court ruled that the state of Colorado violated the First Amendment's Free Exercise Clause when it said that baker Jack Phillips had violated the state's public accommodations law. However, because the court based its decision on how the state's Civil Rights Commission treated the baker, it may not set a precedent in other cases. According to the decision written by Justice Anthony Kennedy, the commission showed a clear and impermissible hostility, quoted there, toward Phillips' sincere religious beliefs. He also said Colorado lawmakers are free to enact anti-discrimination laws when they believe a particular group is being discriminated against. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote a dissenting opinion. She said the comments of one or two members of the state's Civil Rights Commission shouldn't override a lower court's ruling siding with the couple, Charlie Craig and David Mullins. Lydia Wheeler is a legal and regulatory affairs reporter with The Hill. Lydia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Lydia, I think a lot of people are watching this case thinking this was going to decide things one way or another when the right to same-sex marriage collides with the right of people based on religious preferences not to provide these services. It did not do that, did it?
That's right. I think a lot of people saw that or thought that this would be kind of a big landmark ruling either for gay rights or against gay rights. LGBT rights advocates feared that if the court ruled in favor of the baker, that it would give businesses a license to discriminate against gay people. But the court didn't go that far here. And that's what's so interesting, is that they said that we don't really have to reach those First Amendment claims that the baker had asked for the court to side with him on. And they said instead, we're going to look at the way the Civil Rights Commission, which first heard this dispute, we're going to look at the way that they treated him. And in writing the majority opinion, Justice Anthony Kennedy said that at least one commissioner on the seven-member panel had disparaged his religious beliefs, calling them despicable, and that another had compared them to defenses of slavery in the Holocaust. And he said basically that there was an inherent bias on the commission, and that Jack Phillips, this baker, didn't get a neutral adjudication.
That means that this particular ruling doesn't necessarily provide precedent unless there's another case where another state's civil rights commission behaves in a similar way. Is that right?
That's right. So this case is very specific only to the facts of this case. But what's interesting is because they didn't resolve these kind of larger claims of religious liberty and that this kind of leaves the door open, at least some are saying, for kind of other cases to kind of come up through the pipeline that also challenges the same thing. And there's actually a case already out of the state of Washington that's kind of waiting in the wings. There's a flower shop in the state that refused, a florist refused to make a floral arrangement for a same-sex wedding and then was sued by the state's attorney general. And she's asked the court to hear her appeal since the lower courts ruled against her and had said that she had discriminated against this couple. So the cases are almost identical. The only difference between the two is that that case didn't go before a civil rights commission. So there's not the facts in this case. There's not that opportunity there for, you know, the other side to say, or for them to say, you know, these commissioners had a bias against me or didn't provide kind of a neutral enforcement of the law, as that was the claim in the Masterpiece Cake case.
Do we have a sense of when this flower case might end up at the being accepted by the U.S. Supreme Court?
Right. So it was, they asked the court last year, I think in July, to hear this appeal. The court hasn't done anything with it yet. It was put on there. The justices sit for conferences, usually weekly, and they decide which cases they're going to add to their docket for the following term. And it's been relisted for this Thursday for their conference then. So we'll see. Maybe because they issued the ruling in the Masterpiece Cake case today, that might give them, you know, a strong footing to decide whether or not they should hear this particular appeal. They could grant it, and then they could also deny it. They could say, you know, there isn't this issue of the way anybody, you know, the enforcement of the law as there was in the Phillips case, and so we don't feel like there's any dispute we need to resolve. Or they could decide to take the case, and then kind of we're back to square one next term and kind of handling these same issues.
Lydia Wheeler is with us, legal and regulatory affairs reporter at The Hill, looking at this U.S. Supreme Court ruling on a Colorado baker, a same-sex couple, LGBT rights, and religious freedom. The Supreme Court ruled with the baker, but not in a way that necessarily sets a precedent for a lot of other cases. And Lydia, there have been headlines out there, Supreme Court in a narrow ruling. It's a 7-2 ruling, and some people said, wait, that doesn't sound narrow. The narrow means the interpretation, the precedent here, not the numbers, right?
That's correct. A 7-2 ruling, it seems expansive, but really when you get down into the weeds and actually read what they're saying here and how what they base their decision on, it's actually very narrow. They're saying that we're only basing our decision on the way that the Civil Rights Commission treated this baker, Jack Phillips, in enforcing the law. We're not going to go as far as to give him what he wanted, which the opposing side says was a license to discriminate against same-sex couples and refuse to make custom cakes for their weddings. So it looks broad in the numbers, but it's actually a very narrow decision. For this reason, that's why there's some disparity between what each side is saying. So the ACLU, which represented the baker, is, kind of going, this is a relief. The court refused to go that far and give, the baker what he wanted and discriminate and give him this license to discriminate. But then on the other side, Jack Phillips' attorneys at Alliance for Defending Freedom are also kind of hailing this as a victory, because they're saying, wait, the court didn't have to go that far because the commission treated him so badly, but, maybe they would have. And they're saying that because the decision was 7-2, that's a win for them, and that these issues will come before the court at a later time, and this ruling could pave the way for that.
Right, and since this ruling didn't go that far, that doesn't mean they didn't talk about those issues, right, in the various opinions and I think sub-opinions. Some of the justices addressed those free speech and discrimination issues, did they?
That's right. So actually, that was something that, Justice Kennedy actually noted. He basically said that, he was careful to say that anti-discrimination laws are still lawful. He said that, in ruling in favor of the baker, that he has to be careful as not to go so far as to give other businesses the ability to discriminate against gay couples. He made several references to that. But also, some of the other justices weren't kind of on board with that thinking. Justice Clarence Thomas, who is the leading conservative on the court, he issued a concurring opinion, siding, with the decision to reverse the lower court ruling. But he said that he would have given Phillips this win. He would have said, actually, Jack Phillips, your cakes are an expression of religion, and that is protected by the First Amendment.
We don't know at this point, based on what the various justices wrote, how they would rule if they took up another case, say like that flower one you mentioned from Washington. Some have tipped their hand, clearly. Some have not.
Right, that's clear. It's not entirely sure that they could get Kennedy on board for that one. Justice Kennedy is the swing vote on the court, and he feels strongly about protections for LGBT people. He was the one who cast the deciding vote in 2015 in the same-sex marriage case. And he was very careful here to say that, I'm only ruling this way in favor of the baker because the commissioners, on the state civil rights commission acted so badly. They said things that they weren't supposed to. And he said that this baker, Jack Phillips, didn't get kind of a neutral proceeding here, and that, that yes, there are laws in the state that can protect LGBT people, but they have to be enforced in a neutral way. So it's not clear if there isn't that kind of dispute amongst the commission and that kind of behavior in another case, it's not clear that the justices, would rule in favor of, whatever businesses decided to refuse service.
And Lydia, is this something we see from the U.S. Supreme Court sometimes where there's the big dramatic issue, everybody's expecting this definitive ruling to set precedent for everybody else in the country, and the court ends up doing this really narrow thing and says, yeah, we're not quite there on the major precedent yet?
Oh, totally. This happens all the time. You know, the court is also very cautious about its public perception. It doesn't want to be viewed as this body that is making laws. It respects states' rights to do that and Congress's right to enact legislation that accomplishes these goals. So whenever it can, it does look to issue a narrow ruling or leave it to the states or Congress to decide. And that's what some groups have pointed to. The ACLU was quick to say that, you know, hey, this decision, actually, I think it was the Log Cabin Republicans, which is an LGBT rights group on the right, you know, said that this highlights the need for federal anti-discrimination for legislation for LGBT people. So it's pretty common here to see the court try to not only come up with a consensus and get as many justices on one side as they can, but also to kind of tread carefully.
Lydia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Lydia Wheeler, legal and regulatory affairs reporter with The Hill. We talked with her about the U.S. Supreme Court siding with the Colorado baker who refused to make a cake for a same-sex marriage celebration, but not setting precedent for comparable cases around the country. First, there will be some big changes at Wisconsin's youth prisons under a new settlement between the state and teen inmates. The deal would end the use of pepper spray at the two facilities, Copper Lake and Lincoln Hills, and it will also restrict future use of solitary confinement. Patrick Marley is a state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. He's been following this story. Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Rob.
Remind us, Patrick, who brought this lawsuit? What were they alleging?
Last year, inmates represented by the ACLU and the Juvenile Law Center sued alleging that the conditions there were unconstitutional and violated the civil rights of the inmates. A judge within 6 or 8 months sided with them in an initial ruling that put an injunction in place, finding that their civil rights likely were being violated, and scheduling a trial. That initial order restricted the use of pepper spray, restricted the use of solitary confinement and handcuffs and other restraints. And from there, both sides went into settlement talks. Obviously, that was kind of behind the scenes, so we didn't know exactly what was happening there. They reached this agreement last week that goes further than the injunction in terms of diminishing the use of pepper spray and solitary confinement, and found a permanent solution to put that in as the new policy for the state that would be in effect not just for these two prisons, but for any juvenile lockup that the state is going to be operating. There was recently an agreement to close Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake and replace them with about five new juvenile lockups around the state.
Yeah, let's talk a little more about that context before we dig into this settlement more, Patrick. As you say, Lincoln Hills, Copper Lake are on the way out, and this all stems from allegations of abuse and neglect at the facilities, lack of worker safety. We've been talking about these problems for a long time.
Yeah, there's been a criminal investigation that's more than 3 years old now. The FBI has been heading it for about 2 years, looking into a broad range of problems. Two former guards have been notified that they could be charged. That's involving an incident involving a juvenile who had his arm broken while he was in custody. We don't know what other things exactly the FBI may be looking at, but there are plenty of allegations. And, you know, this lawsuit was just one of, I think there are at least four other pending, one from two girls from Iowa who had had been staying at Lincoln or at Copper Lake as on part of a contract. The youth who had his arm broken by the guards, allegedly, and there's another case that I'm not recalling at the moment. And then, of course, the state just recently reached a settlement with a fifth inmate for $19 million, which is the largest, or at least one of the largest, civil rights settlements between the state and an inmate over civil rights.
Well, let's get into the details of this settlement. Solitary confinement, is that gone there, or just restricted in how it's get used, how it gets used under the settlement?
So there's a sort of a phase-in period of many months because it's, you know, a big change to the institution and how it manages its population. But there will be no solitary confinement for punitive purposes. So it used to be, or it is currently, if you violate certain rules, you get put in solitary confinement for days or weeks. Now they won't be able to do that at all. They will be able to use solitary confinement in instances where an inmate is a physical threat to someone else, but they can only do it in four-hour increments. They can get extensions for that, but there has to be this constant effort to get the juvenile out of solitary and into general population. If they're held there for longer than 24 hours, it needs to be because they're going to be moved to another facility, presumably a facility that's more intensive in its mental health care.
And then the use of pepper spray at Lincoln Hills in particular has gotten a lot of attention. What changes there now?
They won't be able to use it at all. Again, there's a phase-in period for that, but they will not be able to deploy it at Lincoln Hills or Copper Lake or any of these new facilities at all.
With both of those, I've seen people cite those as possible safety concerns. Lincoln Hills has been understaffed a lot of the time. The staff would need to be retrained in techniques to manage inmates. Have people raised concerns over safety of inmates and staff without those, or what some people have referred to as tools?
Yeah, so when they rolled out the pepper spray a few years ago at Lincoln Hills and made it more widely available to guards, the argument was that it is safer for both the guard and the inmate to incapacitate someone with pepper spray than putting your hands on them and trying to physically restrain them. You know, whenever you put your hands on an inmate, you have the risk of, you know, broken bones or some other injury. And so the idea was that the pepper spray would be more likely to more safely stop what's happening. The concern of the ACLU and other advocates for the juveniles is that it's used far too often, that it's used in a threatening manner, and that it's not used in the way that it's that you're supposed to do. There's supposed to be a certain distance. It's supposed to be used in sort of a sweeping motion so that you fog an area around an inmate, and they found instances where people were squirted directly in the face at very short distances. It's going to be a concern for the staff not having the pepper spray. They're going to raise concerns about feeling less safe. The Department of Corrections officially says that it believes that it can manage its population safely and appropriately without pepper spray. That's why they reached this agreement.
Patrick Marley is with us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at a settlement between the state's Department of Corrections and youth inmates, changing procedures at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, the state's youth prisons, which are scheduled to be phased out and replaced. This settlement, Patrick, also provides for someone to monitor conditions at the facilities to make sure these policies are being followed. Who's doing that? How's that going to work?
So they've hired a consultant. She will have access to the facility. She'll be able to inspect it, you know, physically go there, look around, I think four times in the first year, and then twice a year after that. She'll have broad access to the records that have been that the Department of Corrections maintains about the facility, and so she will be an independent entity who can make sure that they're actually following this agreement, and that's going to be a very significant element here, because there will be someone there holding the state's feet to the fire, so to speak.
And Patrick, what kind of reactions you've been hearing about the settlement from various stakeholders?
You know, the ACLU and Juvenile Law Center are very pleased with this. The advocates for the inmates feel like they're on a string of victories here because of this decision to close the facility and put these new facilities in place. And I think they view these changes as extremely significant because, like I said, they will apply to these new facilities. There's been a concern among some who are advocates for the youth in prison there that if the state isn't careful, it will go from having one big problem at one large facility to five big problems at five small facilities. And so by having this independent monitor there, there'll be an ability to make sure right out of the gate that things are running as they should. I actually haven't heard much from the staff so far. In the past, the staff has been very troubled by the injunction, feeling like it took away their ability to manage the population to some extent. I imagine there's going to be those kinds of concerns lingering. You know, the staff up there is very frustrated by the lack of a full staff. It's been a real problem for the Department of Corrections to find and retain staff there. That's going to continue to be a problem. They're going to be short-staffed for the foreseeable future. And so they're going to have to, you know, get new training and new programs in place, but they're going to have to do it when they're not at full strength. That's going to be a problem that they wrestle with for some time now.
And Patrick, I think a lot of people on various sides of this issue are hopeful that these newer, smaller facilities will help solve a lot of these problems. But what's the timeline? How much longer is there for the big facilities up north?
So it's supposed to close in by 2021. You know, I think we'll be right against that timeline. I think it'd be hard for the state to get everything up and running before then because some of these facilities are going to be run by counties. Some of them will be run by the state. They've got to determine where they're going to be, which counties want to be involved. The counties that, you know, where they're not located will have to make decisions about who they contract with. The idea usually is that you want to have the juveniles as close to their home county as possible so that they can see family and friends and access the services that they'll access when they get out easily. There's a lot of unknowns there as they put the pieces together here. So I think they're probably going to need every day that they have between now and 2021 to make that happen.
And briefly, Patrick, as we wrap up, this settlement has all these changes, ending the use of pepper spray, changing solitary confinement, the other things we've talked about. And you've mentioned there's a roll-in period. Do we have a sense of when this settlement would be in full effect?
So it's going to next go to, because it's a class action lawsuit, the judge makes it available for anybody who qualifies as a class, which is basically anybody who's incarcerated there, to review it and challenge it. You know, sometimes in class action lawsuits, I don't think you'd see this with this one, but sometimes people don't like the deal that is cut. So will be an opportunity for others to weigh in if they don't like aspects of it. The judge will ultimately you know, presuming that he agrees with it, we'll sign off on it sometime in the next maybe 2 months. And then from there, you start this clock with about a year, various things, you know, some things phase in after 6 or 7 months, some things a full year. I believe it's pepper sprays after a year that they end that. And so then they'll go through that process. But the monitoring would probably occur for 3 or more years of these facilities and then the new ones that are being built.
We'll leave it there. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That's Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel looking at this new settlement on the state's youth prisons and practices there. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Right now, it's the first Monday of the month, which means it's time for another edition of Mondays with Mike. Each month, Wisconsin Public Radio Director Mike Crane or Director of Content Mike Arnold join Central Time or The Morning Show to bring us up to speed on WPR programming and operations. Mike Crane is with us today. A lot to discuss, including a new host of The Morning Show, some special political series, upcoming community events, and more. And we want to hear what you have to say or ask about WPR at 800-642-1234. Did you get a chance to listen to the new morning show today? What do you want to hear more or less of on WPR? And do you have questions about what's going on behind the scenes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Mike Crane is the director of Wisconsin Public Radio. Mike, welcome back.
It's great to be here, and it was nice to tune in and hear Carrie, who's new to Wisconsin, get a great introduction in her very first hour when the discussion was about great moments in Wisconsin history. And so she's off to a good start. She had the state capitol report, as we do on Mondays, and more topics tomorrow. Kevin McKinley stops by to be with her on the morning show. It's great to have Carrie in our midst, and also just a huge thank you to Kate Archer-Kent, who I think probably ended up subbing for much longer than she'd planned, just because
they call
how
that long go. Relief in baseball.
Yes, that's right, the long reliever. And so thanks to both them and to Carrie for joining us, and I look forward to hearing what people think of Carrie and her show as things develop.
Yeah, it's always a big change when there's a change of who's behind the microphone here.
Oh yeah, you know, there's no doubt that this was a momentous year for us with two very longtime hosts retiring and another one moving on to another job. The one-time co-host of this show, and so that's pretty jolting when you think about the fact that people are listening to the radio in intimate spaces, like mm-hmm. their car with maybe just themselves, or in the kitchen, or things like that. These are familiar people. We feel like we know them after a while, and so it's a big change. Well, I hope you'll get to know Carrie and think, as we do, that she's going to be a great addition to the team.
And Kate, we will still hear her voice on both of our networks.
That's right. For the moment, what we're going to have Kate doing is she's going to start subbing on Morning Edition on the News and Classical Network, where we're looking for a new host for the local portions of the show, because Maureen McCollum, who'd been doing that job, is now the new producer of our Wisconsin Life
right.
series. Things change.
Right. And it's fun. I mean, people have worn different hats here over the years. Maureen, a familiar voice. You hear her on the Ideas Network, on the Morning News, on the other network a lot more. And now she's doing a new cool thing for her.
Yeah. And, you know, you weren't always the host of Central Time.
True.
Maybe it feels like that for the last couple
of
years.
It feels like a long time. It feels really new in a lot of ways, too.
Right.
Let's go to our callers, Mike. Rose is with us in Menominee Falls. Rose, hi.
Hi there. I'm calling because I heard Kate Archer-Kinn, I believe, last week or before, saying that the Friday morning political show, where they have guests from two different sides give their presentation, that was going to be reevaluated. And that is one of the shows that I absolutely always tune into. And so I would really, really hate to see that. There have been a lot of other changes, and I miss Kathleen Dunn. I miss some of the more local shows. But anyway, my opinion is, please don't take that away.
Rose, thanks a lot for the call. And that is at least a temporary change, and there's going to be some thought as to what happens there, Mike?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that happens when you have a new and very creative person in your midst is you look at everything you're doing and you say, should we keep doing that? And one of the things that, Rose, thank you so much for that comment. One of the things that we've heard sometimes on the Mondays with Mike segment is people saying, well, you have a politics thing the very next hour on point. Why do you need two? And so that's something we're thinking about. And I think Carrie wants to have a chance to kind of feel how she's doing in the show and get to know our state better. And so it may come back. It may be a little different. We just don't know quite yet, but definitely in hiatus for a little bit.
Rose, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Kenneth in Janesville. Kenneth, hi.
Hello. I know there's this tradition of not having a biography of the people coming new on the air, but I wish we knew more about the people that are coming talking to us from the cloud, so to speak.
Kenneth, thanks a lot. We have some of that online, right, Mike, about Carrie, and I talked to Carrie on the show last Friday. So she comes to us, I can fill in a little bit of the details for you. She comes to us from public radio, hosting in Las Vegas. Basically exactly the same kind of place as Wisconsin. I think I made that joke on Friday. Kind of a different place. She also had some years working in Chicago. So she's
familiar with the Midwest.
The weather
specific.
Won't be a shock to her coming from, because that's what you worry about, right? Somebody coming from Nevada.
Why would they want to come to this really cold place with lots of darkness?
But she's ready to rock.
It's a wonderful
that.
Place. That's why.
But we do have, I think at WPR.org, I think there's some bio information about
that. That's right. And I was going to mention this later, but one of the ways you can often find out about people and things going on is to subscribe to our e-newsletter. It's called Radio Waves, and you can just go to wpr.org/radiowaves and sign up for that, and that typically is where you'll find the bio of the new person. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, you can search around WPR.org to find things, but that'll send you the link. So that's a really good idea to sign up for that.
I do that so much, Mike. I'm subscribed twice on one of my personal email accounts and on my work account here. So I saw that bio of Carrie not once, but two times.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for that call. Kenneth, I want to look at some more of the news out there here, Mike. We've got a governor's race going on in Wisconsin. You may have known that. I think you might have been aware of that, Mike.
Oh, yes.
And our news people, our state capitol staff in particular, they're profiling, a lot of candidates.
Yeah, one of the challenges at this moment in the development of the governor's race and the Democratic side is there are 10 qualified candidates. How do you get to know that many people and make decisions if you're going to be voting in a Democratic primary? Well, one of the ways is to take advantage of the candidate profiles that we'll be doing, and we'll cover the Republican side too, the governor, but just WPR.org to listen anytime, or you will hear the profiles on an ongoing basis on both of our networks, because we're trying to make sure that you do have an opportunity to become informed about the people that are running.
And you'll hear those on both networks, and we'll play one of those. We had Governor Walker's profile on the show on Friday. We start the Democrats today, and that'll play at 4:55 and 6:55. I think I have those times right, so people can meet that bevy of Democratic candidates starting today.
And, you know, that'll obviously thin out as time goes on, but we do really, and this goes back forever, we've always wanted to make sure that people can be good citizens of the state and have the opportunity to think about the candidates and the issues, and this is one of those opportunities.
Talking to Mike Crane, director of Wisconsin Public Radio, it's Mondays with Mike. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Back to your calls. Mike is with us in Appleton. Mike, hi.
Hi. So, again, I wanted to echo the sentiment of the first caller. Week in Review is probably my favorite show of the week, although I listen every day from 6 to 9 to the morning show. And in this time of divisiveness to the nth degree, I really feel to hear a progressive and a conservative, speak genuinely but politely to each other is important. I know you have to make decisions, but I just wanted to have my voice heard.
Great. Thank you, Mike. And you said something really key in your comments that I know won't change, which is the opportunity to speak politely and respectfully with each other. That's a really key part of our values at Wisconsin Public Radio. And whether the format is exactly the same or not, you can absolutely rely on us covering issues and inviting people to disagree agreeably is what we call it here. And so thanks for the input. And I know one of the things is that our program team really does pay attention to the comments they hear, not just on Mondays with Mike, although they do, but also your emails and your letters and all that. That input is really helpful to them.
And thanks a lot for that call, Mike. We've talked about doing that a little more on Central Time, too. A lot of times we would have, if we do, you know, two sides on an issue as opposed to just kind of one summing up the issue, mm-hmm. we might do one here, one there. We periodically had an interesting back and forth about Wisconsin's economy with a couple economists on either side of a debate. We've done that on other issues. That's something we could do more, even if we don't bill it as a weekly thing.
Yeah.
So that's an option, too. Thanks a lot. Great to hear from you, Mike. Let's go next to Brad in Avoca. Brad, hi.
Hi, Rob and Mike. It's nice to hear you and love Central Time. Love the network. My comment would be, well, I also want to quickly echo that I like the Week in Review. But my main comment would be on 9 p.m. on these weeknights on the Ideas Network, I wonder if we could just repeat some locally produced programming that people don't have time to hear either during the day or during the weekend. I know it's too expensive to make a show or buy a show, but I was wondering if instead of the BBC on that 9 to 10 p.m., if we could go back to replaying like you have in the past.
Thanks, Brad. That is for listeners that haven't been around quite as long. That is something we used to do a lot more extensively a number of years ago. And until pretty recently, we had at least an hour here and there in the evening that were repeats of the daytime shows. Repeats are such an issue for us. We're never sure which way to go. Some things we repeat on the weekends, although we've reduced some of that over time. And because of the extensive availability of podcasting and the internet, some of the comments here, in terms of the programming staff and some listeners as well, is you need something fresh. I'm tuning in not to hear the thing I already heard this morning. And then we hear from Brad, who sees the other way. Mm-hmm. So we do our best to choose. But thanks, Brad, for the comment.
Thanks a lot for the call. We are talking to Mike Crane, director of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's the June edition of Mondays with Mike. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts on what you hear on the air. 800-642-1234. What program or kind of program would you like to hear on Wisconsin Public Radio, especially on weekends? Do you have questions about what we do here? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin Public Radio Director Mike Crane is with us talking about all things WPR on the June edition of Mondays with Mike. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Call in with your thoughts on what you hear on Wisconsin Public Radio, your questions about what goes on here and behind the scenes for that matter. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Before we go back to our callers, Mike, a couple of things I want to make sure we get to. Some of our listeners in the La Crosse area may have heard and have told us they've heard something a little off going on. What's going on in the La Crosse transmitter?
The transmitter WHLA-FM is sometimes, for the moment, needing to go either to very low power or maybe even off occasionally if needed. What's going on is that we're rebuilding the WHLA-TV channel on that tower. As a result of a longer conversation than we have, the channels for a lot of TV stations around the country have been changing, and we're taking the opportunity to get everything fixed up for the future on that television channel for Wisconsin Public Television. In order to keep the tower workers safe, sometimes we got to turn things down so that they can safely move through the spot on the tower where the FM transmitter is without too much exposure to radio waves. So we'll get that fixed soon. I don't have an exact date, but the latest reports we're seeing is that the work is going very well. In the meantime, thank you for bearing with us.
And I wanted to take a peek at some community events we have coming up, Mike. We've got some coming up actually as soon as this week, right?
Yeah, we have the Simply Folk Shindig. That's going to be this Thursday. Three great Wisconsin bands, Art Stevenson and Highwater, Joseph Huber and Nicolin Rose. And we'll have live music and food and drink and a lively dance floor. And that is at the Rothschild Pavilion just outside Wausau. But don't let it stop you if you're a little farther from Wausau, because it's a lot of fun. And that's, again, that's Thursday, June 7th, this week.
And then we've got one in Stevens Point on the 23rd, a Saturday.
Yeah, you know, we have a mix of ticketed and free events. This one is a listener appreciation event at Farm Shed in Stevens Point. Light refreshments. I know for sure that Stephanie Elkins from the News and Classical Network and Larry Mueller from this network are planning to be there. And some folks from our regional Central Wisconsin office will be there as well. And you don't have to register, but I'll suggest that you do, because you can make sure you'll get your free WPR pint glass at the event. And you can register at WPR.org/presents.
Let's go back to our callers. Frank is with us in Onalaska. Frank, hi.
Hi, Mike. Hi, Rob. Thanks
hi.
For taking my call. Usually the programming is excellent. The hosts and guests are right on. But you've got some new on-air talent, as some of the old folks have gone their own ways. So when those new hosts mispronounce Wisconsin place names, Indian names, you know, old listeners like me cringe. So maybe just that introduction for take a week, take a map, read every name you can see, practice with somebody that knows those names, because there's nothing worse than to hear something mispronounced in our home state.
Frank, thanks. I remember, I think I mostly get them right now. I'm a resident of Wisconsin for about 10 years. But I know that one of my challenges was I had to know that I didn't know.
Right.
And so we'll work with Carrie on that and any of the other hosts. For instance, when I look at what I know now is Waupun, it looks to me like Waupun, if it looks like, you know, anything. Or Muscadet looks like Muscoda. But it isn't. And so one of the things we rely on, everyone that loves language probably enjoy this, is there's a website we look at when we know we're wrong. It's called Mispronouncer, MISSPronouncer.com. And she's a great big help in helping us to figure that out. But thanks for the reminder.
Yeah, I've been here 27 years in Wisconsin now. And every now and then a caller comes in with one that's new to me. And I have that moment of, am I going to get this right? We've got a lot of place names in Wisconsin. And we've got we still have those. Yeah, I see it right there, the blue book that when I was a call screener here, I used to use and flip through and make sure I was spelling it right.
It was written actually right here at our station many years ago.
Right.
We keep copies around.
Still very useful. I hope somebody digitized that somewhere so we can't just lose it accidentally.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for that call. Let's go to Tom in, here's one, but it's in Iowa, so I can be forgiven. Tom in Waukon, Iowa?
Waukon,
Iowa. Okay, it's in Iowa, so I'm going to forgive myself this one, Tom. But go ahead, Tom. What did you want to bring up?
I want to ask Mike about an issue of fairness in terms of reporting. back when he first came on as a head of WPR, he addressed a club, Niagara Club, in Madison, and indicated that the National Public Radio tracks Middle Eastern coverages, so to speak, as to which side of issues, you know, the program may look like it's favoring. And afterwards, he indicated that, you know, kind of private discussion, that NPR really didn't change much because that percentage pretty much stayed the same. So my question is, Mike, have you done anything in terms of Wisconsin Public Radio to try to balance that kind of coverage out? And if the second question is, if stuff isn't changed, what's the purpose of tracking that stuff? And I hope it's not to advertise to a particular group of donors that you're still on message, to be frank.
Yeah, thank you for the comments. I don't recall the exact nature of that conversation. That was, you have a good memory, Tom. It was a long time ago that I did that discussion. But I at that time, and I would have to check and see where NPR stands in terms of those tracking things right now. But at that time, NPR was doing a regular tracking of their coverage of Israel. Because that's NPR, if you mean do I track that about Israel for WPR programs, I don't. We don't often take up that topic. We tend to be much more focused on state and national, not international issues. Not that we never cover them. I always appreciate people's thoughts on those things as we go. You know, we really aren't beholden to any donors other than we try to serve you all very well. And so we're not trying to impress a donor with any of our coverage. We're trying to do our best to do a good job of covering the news and having the conversations that you would expect us to have on the Ideas Network. So thanks for the comment, Tom.
Tom, thanks for that call. We'll go next to, let's go to Tom in Port Wayne. Tom, hi.
That's Port Wing.
Port Wing. See, I'll blame that's, yeah.
That's our call screener's fault.
Well, I don't want to throw anybody under the bus. Port Wing, I know. Well, Port Wayne, I didn't.
I called last month to talk to Mike. I was a chair of the Republican Party, 40-plus year listener to Wisconsin Public Radio, so I'm not just a fly-by-nighter. The representation of Republicans on Wisconsin Public Radio is pathetic. Your weekend edition, as far as I'm concerned, the Republicans are weak. Many of them, some are good, but many are weak. And I'm wondering when we're going to see some real conservative Republican voice on Wisconsin Public Radio. We also pay taxes.
Tom, I'm going to jump in because we're just about out of time. Thanks for calling from Port Wayne.
Yeah, Tom, thanks for the comments. I think we do a really pretty good job of welcoming people from all different stripes. Sometimes people won't agree to come on because they have sort of a notion of who we are and maybe haven't discovered that they're going to do, like we talked about earlier in the show today, they're going to be respected and listened to. And I'm sorry that your perception is what it is, but we really do want to have a great variety of voices on the air. I think deeply inside what we think is that the solutions to our problems, whether that's local, state, national, whatever, the solutions are in trying to have dialogue with each other. You know, we don't on any side all have the right ideas. We got to work it out together.
Thanks for that call. Just real briefly, Mike, people may have been hearing about the UW Extension, UW Madison merger. We're going to be shuffled. We're part of this news. Is this going to affect what people hear that much?
I really don't think so. One of the things that has happened as we've been talking with our soon-to-be new bosses at UW Madison as opposed to UW Extension where we've been housed, they get us. They understand, first of all, that WPR it was invented right on the campus of UW-Madison. And you can tell, too, that they really understand and embrace the idea that we are a statewide service, and they are glad to be a part of that. So we look forward to that new relationship.
Mike, good to talk to you. Look forward to hearing you on the morning show next month. That was Mike Crane, director of Wisconsin Public Radio. He stops by the first Monday of the month on Central Time or the morning show to talk about the latest on WPR programming and answer your questions, too. It's National Cheese Day, a big day for us here in Wisconsin. A lot of people are celebrating online anyway, sharing pictures of whatever cheese they happen to be eating today. A lot of Wisconsin politicians and media figures and others have been weighing in. Not to rain on your cheese parade, but the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission celebrated the event with a warning. I'm quoting from their tweet here. They have fun with these. The cheese can't cut itself, but you can. 3,700 cheese-related emergency room visits in 2017. Why is cheese sending us to the emergency room? By and large, it's not the cheese. They say it's the knives that we're using to cut the cheese, whether it's the cutting of the cheese or, this is the part that freaks me out usually, you've got the tight package, maybe it's an older cheese, so it's a little more of a durable, it's not that flimsy plastic wrap, and you've got the scissors you're trying to get in there or the knife you're trying to get that initial cut in. That's where I worry. Knock on wood, I haven't gotten myself on cheese yet. Also, the graters. I don't know if this causes people to go to the ER. Be careful with those cheese graters. I've gotten myself grating vegetables for like relish and things like that. So enjoy National Cheese Day responsibly and safely. Thanks to that from the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.